This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice by going to audible.com/acastofkings. That's audible.com/acastofkings. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen.
I'm Jonah Robinson.
And together we are reading A Game of Thrones from George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. We're also watching the television show along with it. Typically, Joanna and I split up our duties in the sense that Joanna reads the books and I only watch the show, but we're doing a season one rewatch. And so this week, we're going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 5, The Wolf and the Lion. We'll be spoiling everything through the show, Game of Thrones. But we will not be spoiling anything from future books past Season 5 of Game of Thrones. And we will be discussing in depth the episode, Season 1, Episode 5, as well as the accompanying chapters in George R. R. Martin's book. So let's get into this week's episode, shall we, Jonah Robinson? Season 1, Episode 5, The Wolf and the Lion, was directed by Brian Kirk and written by Weiss and Benioff. And this episode picks up at the tournament that we saw a little bit of in last week's episode. We see Ned and Sir Barristan Selmy, right?
Yeah.
Talking over the dead body of John Arryn's old squire, Sir Hugh.
Yeah.
And they talk a little bit about I think we had a question in last week's podcast about why was Sir Hugh marked for death? I think it's more clear in this episode why that is, right? At least
that's the implication, right? Like, Ned is suspicious. He's like, who set him up? Who, you know, who matched him? And that sort of stuff. And I think later Varys mentions that Sir Hugh, this is directly from the book, that Sir Hugh owed everything he had to John Arryn, but when Lysa left, Sir Hugh stayed behind and was made a knight immediately. So it just makes it more suspicious, right?
Right. And in the book, I think there's a pretty clear implication that Sir Hugh is the one that poisoned John Arryn.
Which turns out to not be true. So I don't know. Right. I think it's just like it's a Varys scheme. And what we learn, I mean, the most important thing I think we learn in this episode is a look at Varys's bigger plan. Right. And so, you know, as much as you want to believe Varys, you want to believe that I believe that he likes Ned and I believe that generally he's on Ned's side, but we know that he has a bigger scheme in motion. And so a lot of what he's doing is in the interest of pitting Ned against Robert, actually. Mm. So, mm. Right.
For reasons that we will get into shortly.
Yes.
So Ned and Sir Barristan have a nice moment where they kind of admire each other's awesomeness, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
They have a nice little moment. You learn a little bit about them, right?
It's like two men of honor. They're all these like scheming bastards around Ned, and Sir Barristan's like the only one who matches him, I think, for honor at King's Landing, right?
Yeah, yeah. We also get a little bit of – well, Ned basically was admiring how skilled Sir Barristan was as well. Then we get a scene with King Robert – and trying to get into his armor because he wants to joust today, but Ned says that's a terrible idea. Anything from this scene? I do want to say it's very, very funny. I thought King Robert was basically doing like a Joe Pesci from Goodfellas impression.
Yeah, yeah.
That was only in the show, too. It was.
Do I amuse you?
Yeah, very good. And basically leaving Lancel no way out. So
yeah.
So very good. And in the book, they make it more clear that Ned is very suspicious of King Robert being surrounded by all these Lannisters, right?
Right, and later Varys implies that the reason Robert wanted to join the melee, which isn't like even the jousting, it's like a free-for-all sort of fight thing that we don't actually see on screen, but the reason that Robert wanted to join it was because Cersei told him he shouldn't, and basically Varys implies that Cersei is trying to get Robert killed
right.
in this melee.
Cersei was reverse psychology-ing right. Robert into right. going into the joust. So yeah, that's all not in the show.
Right.
Instead, what we have in the show is just a very nice moment between Robert and Ned, which serves as a great contrast to what happens later on in the episode.
Yeah, before everything goes to shit in their friendship.
Definitely.
It's yeah. a lovely scene, yeah.
And then there's this kind of odd scene between the Mountain and Sir Loras. There's also, in the book, there's a scene with Sir Jaime that isn't in the show, right?
Right.
But then the Mountain and Sir Loras have this big jousting battle. Right before it happens, Sir Loras gives Sansa a rose, which is kind of a nice nod to, in the book, how Sansa is smitten with him. And so Loras' horse is in heat. I didn't really understand this. I've read this in the book and in the show. Can you explain this?
Well, basically, so the way it's explained is that so Sir Loras jousting against the Mountain. The Mountain apparently has a fondness for, big, I think they're destriers, like big horses, big male horses that are, would be susceptible to a mare in heat, I guess. Mm. And so Sir Loras rides in a mare in heat, which causes the Mountain's horse to go crazy and,
displease the Mountain so much that he cuts his head off?
Well, I mean, it throws the match, Loras wins, but right. it's a dirty trick. And in the show, Loras gives this smirk where he knows what he's doing, whereas in the book it's a little more ambiguous.
Right.
But here, Loras is sees the horse, sort of acting up, and he's like, yep, I did that. And then in this crazy moment, the Mountain chops off the first Mountain, the original Mountain, the right. first of three in the show, chops off the head of his horse.
And you're referring to the fact that the Mountain has been played by three different actors during the course of the show. I thought it was interesting how the book also gave the Mountain this very elaborate backstory as well, which
yeah.
we don't see in the show at all. I mean, he's basically just a monster in the show, right?
Right.
But in the book, he is more of – he's also a monster. He's just a monster with a bigger backstory. He has numerous wives who die mysteriously and all this crazy stuff about this character who we know very little about in the show. I don't really know how much you would add. The show needs to make a decision about how expansive it needs to get, right? And I think cutting that stuff out is probably pretty smart. I think the Mountain still is a memorable presence in the show. Would have been more memorable if they kept the same actor.
So. Well, it's interesting because we're going to get to this a little later on about a scene that they – or a couple scenes that they added in. But I was actually earlier this week reading a post by Charlie Jane Anders over on io9.com that's titled "The Deleted Scenes and Last-Minute Changes in the First Two Seasons of Game of Thrones." And, it's based off of, some things that Brian Cogman has written, and a bunch of other things. And one of the deleted scenes that they had sort of planned and gotten rid of was seeing the Mountain sort of terrorize the countryside, which explains, and he's doing it in the name of the Lannisters. And the reason it was in there was to better explain why Ned Stark hates the Lannisters. Mm. And that would have given us a little more information about the Mountain that he was just, but I mean, as you say, he's still just a monster. I think chopping the head off a horse gets you where you need to be in terms of what the Mountain is,
Well, yeah. Plus they have this fight, the Cleganes have this fight. And
yeah, the mini Cleganebowl. Yeah.
It's very clear that he is willing to kill because he's in a rage at that moment.
Yeah. He would kill his brother.
What did you feel like was the purpose of this scene? I guess having seen it, I didn't really understand what was happening the first time I saw it many years ago. Now, of course, I understand the characters and their relationship to each other. I don't really get kind of why, what is the purpose of the scene? I don't know what to take from it. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, the one thing that strikes me, beyond getting to know the Clegane brothers, who will be important as the show goes on, is sort of how ineffectual Robert is in this whole thing. He stops it eventually, but it takes him so long, right? It shouldn't have even gotten to this. it shouldn't have gotten to the mountain unseating Loras, you know, like, right. You know, like those aren't the rules. It shouldn't have gotten to the mountain chopping the head off a horse. Like, this is sort of the court that Robert's running, and it's not quite right. Mm. I don't know. That was sort of a thought I had.
Yeah, that's certainly plausible. I think if the relationship between the Clegane brothers had been developed more in the show, this would have been a formative moment in that. I don't know how well developed it is in the books. It's, you know, better developed in the books thus far than it has been on the show. But do you have any insight into that? Like, is it more obvious what their relationship is in the book, like in the rest of the
book? Well, yeah. I mean, you and I talked about this last week in terms of the Hound giving his own backstory to Sansa and this being a big part of his character. And in the show, it's just sort of Baelish tells the story, right? So I think, you know, just the way that the mountain brutalized the Hound as they were growing up is important to the character of the Hound, who does become a main character. And so it's important to know where he came from and who his brother is. I mean, as you say, I don't think we ever really get to know the mountain. I mean, now he's just like an actual monster.
Right.
But the Hound, I think we're supposed to understand the humanity behind this creature, right?
So yeah.
One thing that I thought was really touching in the book was when, you know, it all ends and the Hound has saved Loras, basically. And there's a line in the book where it's like, and for the first time in his life, the Hound, you know, had the support of the common folk.
Right.
And it was just really sad and poignant, you know?
Yeah.
This guy is probably basically good. I mean, he's doing the bidding of Joffrey, so not great, but like basically good, but monstrous and hideous. So I don't know. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, I don't know. Basically good. That's an interesting thought. He has done good things, right? But he does enjoy killing, right?
Well, I think he's got like a good person in him that's been abused,
right,
and is trying to get out. And so occasionally these things happen where he'll like protect Sansa or kind of protect Arya.
Or protect Loras in this case.
You know, yeah, yeah, protect Loras. Well, that was more like, you know, to fuck with his brother, I think. But like, you know, like, I don't know if that makes me sound like some naive girl. I mean, like, there are these people, I think we've talked about this on the show before, but there are these people who are like obsessed with the Sansa Sandor relationship in the book. They call themselves Sansans, and like they love the Hound and Sansa. I'm not there. I don't think that that's an interesting route to go down personally.
Do they also have wig forums where they gather online? Talk about wigs.
We're going to talk about Loras's wig later, but but I don't love the Hound that much. I just think he's a very interesting character.
That was an instance where actually the show kind of helped my appreciation of the book, where because I know the whole arc of the Hound, mm-hmm, you know, reading that section where he is actually being praised by the common folk, it gave that more resonance, you know what I mean, than if I had just read this book for the first time. So, anyway, more stuff happens at King's Landing this week. Arya is chasing cats per Cyril Farrell's instruction. Mm-hmm. And I think the book does a pretty good job of making Cyril Farrell's instruction seem even more idiosyncratic than it is in the show.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. She's chasing cats, and then we see Varys talking to what looks to me like Magister Illyrio.
Yes.
Right, in the show?
Yes.
In the book, it's not even clear that it's Illyrio. Well,
it is because he has like a forked blonde beard, and I think if you're paying attention,
yes,
that it is Magister Illyrio. But it's from Arya's point of view, and she doesn't know who he is. So she's just like some guy with a foreign accent and a forked yellow beard. I'm not saying it's clear. I'm just saying it's very likely
that it's Illyrio.
Yeah.
But I did have that thought because when the book described him, I thought to myself, is that a description of Illyrio? I don't remember. because I associate him with, you know, the look he has on the show. So
right.
Oh, actually, this doesn't this scene happen after Varys talks to Ned?
Yeah.
That's my recollection. Yeah. So Varys has this conversation with Ned where he explains, hey, Tears of Lys, that's what killed him, and someone's trying to kill Robert.
If the wrong ears heard what I'm about to tell you, off comes my head. And who would mourn poor Varys then? North or south, they sing no songs for spiders. But there are things you must know. You are the king's hand, and the king is a fool. Your friend, I know, but a fool, and doomed unless you save him.
I've been in the capital a month. Why have you waited so long to tell me this?
I didn't trust you.
So why do you trust me now?
The Queen is not the only one who has been watching you closely. There are few men of honor in the capital. You are one of them. I would like to believe I am another, strange as that may seem.
What sort of doom does the King face?
The same sort as John Arryn. The Tears of Lys, they call it. A rare and costly thing. As clear and tasteless as water, it leaves no trace.
In the book, they make it clear that, hey, they tried to kill Robert at the jousting thing today. And then there's a scene afterwards where we see that Varys is not pure of motive, right? That he not only is telling Ned, hey, they're trying to kill Robert, he's saying, hey, maybe we should evaluate killing Ned as well. Or at least Illyrio and him are kind of scheming on what they're going to do.
Yeah, and I mean, Illyrio seems much more willing to kill Ned. Like, I really do think that Varys likes Ned. But Illyrio's like, yeah, one hand died, another hand of the king can die. And Varys is like, well, they're not the same. Like, I think he likes Ned. But his, you know, the episode gets its title from this line where he says, the wolf and the lion will be at each other's throats, we'll be at war soon. So basically he's like dropped these hints for Ned to figure out about, you know, Robert's bastards and all this sort of stuff, you know, so he's like encouraging Ned to be Detective Ned, as you called him, I think last week, which is just going to rile up the Lannisters and start a fight between the Lannisters and the Starks. And what we know now, having seen season 5 of Game of Thrones, is that Varys and Illyrio are plotting because they want the Targaryens back on the throne. So to, you know, start a civil war basically between the Starks and the Lannisters weakens the Westeros, like the Westerosi position, and would make it easier for the Targaryens to come and take the throne.
Right. So what you're saying is that because we learn in later seasons that Varys' whole goal is to get a Targaryen on the throne.
Yeah. I think it's like hinted at here, but not explicitly like really laid out for us until much later.
The
right?
thing that's still confusing about that, though, is why would Varys then be complicit with the murder?
The assassination?
Yeah, the assassination.
I know, I agree. That was like my big question when he revealed himself as pro-Targaryen restoration in season 5. I was like, I don't understand why he was voting for sending an assassin after Daenerys. Unless, okay. You know, what they say in the book and I think in the show a little bit too is like, or no, I think it's mostly in the book, that they're sending like kind of a shitty assassin after Daenerys and the Dothraki will probably catch it in time and then that will inspire them to come cross the Narrow Sea and come after the people who tried to assassinate Daenerys and her baby. That's a big gamble.
That's quite a stretch. I do love the way, we'll get to this later, but I do love the way that Varys explains it to Ned. He says something along the lines of, we have to do vile things sometimes, so vile for the good of the good of the nation. And it just it tickled me because for Varys, it's obviously just something that he's totally used to. It felt like he was explaining it to a child. You know? Ned,
concept of the greater good.
Right, exactly. Ned with his nobility. But saying it in such a way as to be palatable to Ned. I like the layers of that performance. But anyway. Also, the wolf and the lion, just to be clear, those are the house animals of the Starks and also the Lannisters?
The Lannisters, yeah.
Yes, okay. So that's what
as Master Luwin explains later in the episode,
right?
That handy little refresher.
Well, let's go to that. So at Winterfell, there's only a couple scenes this week. There is a scene where Bran and Master Luwin are studying the houses and they're pointing them out on the map, saying what the houses are, and then saying what the house words are.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this scene was to kind of make it clear what the relationship between the houses are geographically, and also let you understand
like what house words are.
Right. I mean, I'll just confess that I literally did not even remember this scene because I guess I just feel like they were trying to make it organic, but I feel like if you're going to explain things to an audience that doesn't have any idea what these things are, you should just do it in an even clearer way. But that's me. A lot of people probably understood what a house words immediately were. What do you think, Joanna? Do you think it's a pretty easy concept to grasp and understand their sigil and so on?
No. I think it was a good stab at it. But what I did love is that it then dovetails into Bran being like pissed off about Catelyn, which I think is good and right. Like that feels organic, you know?
Right. Right.
And I actually thought Isaac Hempstead White's performance, he's so small, but I thought he was really good at sort of showing this like anger at being left by his mom and sort of this concept that the Tully house words are family, duty, honor, and she left her family in theory to protect her family. But like, you know, I thought that part worked. But, you know, the part where they're going through things, you know, trying to have like Theon to interject some jokes and stuff like that, like I think it was a good attempt.
It was a good attempt.
Not the most successful attempt.
That's exactly how I feel. I feel like I don't envy their task, right? It's not easy to convey a sense of who these families are in relationship to each other, the concept of sigils and house words and why those things might represent those families. It's very difficult. I don't know if this was the best way it could have been done. It was a valiant attempt, but I guess my feeling is that for someone who has no idea what they are, it doesn't help that much. And for someone who is already expert at it, it also doesn't help that much because, you know, aside from that moment that you mentioned, not much is added.
I did like how it was echoed throughout, because I feel like then you get some Tyrion stuff about him talking about the Lannister always pays his debts. Doesn't he say that in this episode?
Yeah, and Bran actually mistakenly says.
Yeah, that those are the house words and stuff like that. But just sort of, it rippled a little bit out into the other plots.
Right. But I'm sure we'll get a lot of people writing in saying how obvious it was to them. So,
Well, I mean, I don't know because I came into it knowing,
right?
You know, so I have no idea what it is to come in to that particular concept cold. There are certainly some Game of Thrones concepts or whatever that I had to grapple with. You know, if you're not interested in like medieval history or whatever it is that gives you that nice base, you might struggle with some very basic concepts like, you know, what's a squire? If you've never been to a Ren Faire or paid attention to like knights and whatever, maybe you don't know what a squire is. That's possible. I don't think it's, you know, just because someone doesn't know what a squire is doesn't mean they don't know a lot more than you do about math or something like that. So,
right.
Anyway.
But yeah, I will say watching this scene, now that I know what all those things are, it made sense to me, but I did recall thinking, rewatching it, that, hey, wow, I totally wouldn't understand anything that's going on if I didn't already know. But yeah, I appreciate that they're trying. I just didn't feel like this hit the mark. So, also at Winterfell this week, your favorite character shows up. Roz, right?
I got so excited. I thought we were talking about Jorah.
No.
Roz.
So Roz shows up, and this is another sex position scene. And I want to say the term sex position really only started to be widely used towards the end of the first season. And I had forgotten how brazen it is. You know, rewatching these scenes, it is very clear. They're just using nudity as a way of communicating exposition.
Right.
And this is certainly one of those scenes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, what do we learn from this scene? She's trying to like explain to us the whole like Theon as a ward
right.
situation again, which is a tricky concept to grasp, I think. They struggle, I think, getting the Greyjoy Rebellion backstory in there, I think.
Yeah, I don't even think I really understood it until you explained it to me when I was watching this show for the first time many years ago. And so, yeah, they try to explain it. And then also last week as well, right, there was some commentary from, what do you call it, Tyrion about it too.
Right.
To Theon. So this is all the show's way of trying to explain to you, hey, there was a massive rebellion. It got put down. Theon got stuck with the Starks, right?
Right. But he's not a Stark, and he's kind of loyal to them, but he belongs to this other shitty family. The fun thing about this scene that like a lot of people brought up while watching season 5 is when Cersei sent Jaime to Dorne to rescue Myrcella in season 5. She had that like necklace and a snake and a box sort of thing. And she's like, there's only one of these like this in the world. And I gave it to Myrcella. So it belongs to her. And that's how we know that, you know, the Dornish people are doing something terrible to Myrcella. And then a bunch of showrunners are like, actually, Roz has that same necklace. Tyrion gave it to her. Like, you know, I don't know if like Tyrion's going around the countryside just like peddling these Lannister necklace knockoffs to like whatever whore he encounters or something like that. But that's why a bunch of people thought Cersei like was lying about the necklace, stuff like that. I think it's just a show error, an internal show error, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Well, there's another one of those happening later on this episode, Jenna Robinson.
There sure is.
But we'll get to that in a bit. I know Roz is not your favorite character, but I do think that her relationship with Theon is moderately interesting. I just think that he has, again, this huge chip on his shoulder, and he's kind of he thinks he's better than her, right? But really, he's kind of beholden to her in a way, and we see that a little bit when she says goodbye to him later on in the show. So I will say this scene was not completely useless. I do like that relationship, and it adds to Theon's whole tragic situation. So, and I'll take your silence to be a I don't agree with you, but I'm not gonna argue with you about this point.
Well, as I was watching it, I was just thinking of Roz being an unsuccessful character, honestly. Not shittily, just honestly, because I think the show has created, I can't think of any right now, but I think the show has created or at least made some really good amalgamations of characters that have been successful. And I don't think Roz is one, and then they killed her off. And I certainly don't think Ollie is one. So I just think occasionally they invent these characters out of whole cloth to bridge plot points. And I just don't know that they've nailed that yet.
Well, we disagree on at least one of those characters. So,
whichever one could it be?
Yes. But yeah, it's very – what's also cool about this scene is it's very clear, you know, where the power dynamic is in the sense that, you know, Theon is super frustrated with Roz, and Roz just like – she doesn't – she's cool as a cucumber, man. You know, Theon can like her, doesn't like her. It doesn't matter to her. You know,
she's going to the big city. She doesn't care.
That's exactly right. Theon just can't get Roz to really listen to her and listen to him and kind of internalize what he's saying. But you know what is an enjoyable listening experience, Joanna Robinson?
What's that, David Chen?
Audible.com.
What?
Which is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. And if you go to audible.com/acastofkings, you can get a free audiobook of your choice that you can keep and listen to as many times as you want for as long as you want. Joanna Robinson, I believe you have an Audible recommendation for us today.
I do. I have a couple. The first that I would recommend for lovers of Game of Thrones in general or, you know, fantasy works is Terry Pratchett's The Shepherd's Crown. This is Terry Pratchett's last book. It was actually kind of incomplete, but I would say that the Discworld series by Terry Pratchett, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and those are by far my favorite, narrated by Stephen Briggs. I think they're the best audiobooks out there. So it's a fantasy, sort of like Game of Thrones, except a lot lighter and really funny, but also very poignant. And this last book was very, very touching, knowing that Terry Pratchett, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, left us earlier than he should have, probably.
All right. So the name of the book is what?
The Shepherd's Crown by Terry Pratchett.
The Shepherd's Crown by Terry Pratchett, narrated by Stephen Briggs. If you go to audible.com/acastofkings, that's audible.com/acastofkings, get a free audiobook download. Anything else, Joanna? I think you had two recommendations for us, right?
Yeah, the other one is nothing to do with fantasy, but if you're interested in sort of the art of adaptation, I guess, adapting a book to film or television, I think a really good book to give a listen to is Paula Hawkins' The Girl on the Train, which they are making into a movie with Emily Blunt and Rebecca Ferguson and a bunch of really, really great people. I think Chris Pine is in it. Or maybe Evans, one of the Chris's. Anyway, it's going to
I've heard of this book. I've heard it's great.
Yeah. It's very Hitchcockian. So like if you've seen a Hitchcock film or three, you probably could see the twists coming, but it's narrated by three different women. It's pretty interesting exploration of an unreliable narrator. And I really liked it. And I'm really interested to see what they do with the film. So
cool. Well, that's The Girl on the Train. If you like listening to A Cast of Kings, That means you like sitting around and listening to people talk in your ear holes for many, many hours on end. Audible.com/acastofkings is a great way to get many, many hours of that for free. High quality audio entertainment at audible.com/acastofkings. They're one of our sponsors for this season one rewatch. We really appreciate it. So we hope you will consider going to audible.com/acastofkings, getting a free audiobook, and you'll be supporting A Cast of Kings as well. Let's move on with the podcast, Joanna Robinson. So what else? Let's go to King's Landing again. There's lots of stuff
going on. Most of it takes place at King's Landing. Yeah.
Did we even get any Dany scenes this week? I don't think so, right?
No, no.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
She's talked about a lot.
She's talked about, right. Her presence is felt.
Mm-hmm.
So Arya, after hearing about Illyrio and Varys' conversation, she...
Did you know when you read the book that she was talking about the dragon skulls? When she was talking about like the monsters that she sees down in the crypts?
Did not understand that.
Yeah, because she talks about like, oh, there's a monster in an eyeball. And I thought she was just like young and scared. Like when I first read it, I thought she's just young and scared. I didn't get it and put it together. But then in the show, you like just obviously see her next to some dragon skulls. So you're like, oh, okay. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah. There it is.
There it is.
The conditions I was watching the show in might have been a bit too bright in the room. So I might not have seen some of the more subtle show set dressing elements. But anyway, Arya stumbles out of the sewer and tries to make her way back to King's Landing. And it's actually very amusing the way she does it. She kind of has a conversation with that knight or guard or what have you, and ends up pissing off Ned.
Yeah, she's pretty sassy. She's like, I'm Arya Stark of Winterfell. My father's going to have your head on a stick if you don't let me in. And they were like, they thought she was a beggar and treating her that way. So, yeah.
Pretty awesome. Great. Classic Arya.
Mm-hmm.
Ned gives her a difficult time.
You know I had half my guard out searching for you. You promised me this would stop.
They said they were going to kill you.
Who did?
I didn't see them. But I think Orm was fat.
Oh, Arya.
I'm not lying. They said you found the bastard, and the wolves are fighting the lions, and the savage. Something about the savage.
Where did you hear this?
In the dungeons, near the dragon skulls.
What were you doing in the dungeons?
Chasing a cat.
Well, like, the sad thing about this is that Arya has this information for Ned, and he doesn't. He brushes her off in the book, and he brushes her off here.
He brushes her off even harder in the book, as far as I recall, because the way she conveys it is even more implausible.
Incoherent.
In the book.
She's like, there was a monster, and then there was like a wizard, and all that stuff like that. He's like, cool, go to bed, you're hallucinating.
At least it's somewhat plausible in the show.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's trying to tell him, hey, your life might be in danger.
Right.
Which he's going to find out pretty shortly anyway.
I love that, like, they say, oh, he's got the one bastard, and they're talking about Gendry. And she's like, they said you had one bastard. I think they mean John. Like, she's trying to figure it out. She's like, I can figure this out. I can crack this code. She's wrong, but she's trying.
Yeah. So then we meet Jorin. And
Jorin meets Arya.
Jorin meets Arya, and that's a very consequential meeting for reasons we'll discover later. And Jorin goes to tell Ned what, Joanna?
Your wife done fucked up. Exactly. I believe are his exact words.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly straight out of the book as well. but yeah, he tells Ned that, hey, your wife has taken the imp, and that is a bad situation for everyone.
Yeah.
And I think in rewatching it, you realize just how horrible of a decision that was. Like, how Catelyn – I guess the question I have is, doesn't Catelyn understand how much jeopardy she's putting everyone in? Do you know? She seems to be a rational person, but these are not rational decisions that she's making, right?
Right, and I think in the book you get – because it's like from Tyrion's point of view, right? So you get his point of view of this is so stupid. And she's smarter than he gives her credit for, but she's still – it's a very stupid move that she made here. And I think she thought – well, we know she thought that Lysa would be a better ally for her. And then she goes to Lysa, does not get what she's hoping for.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. A scene we skipped is – this Littlefinger and Varys in the throne room, where it's just Littlefinger and Varys talking about like what they know and how they're spying and stuff like that. And there's another one of these scenes later with between Cersei and Robert where they're talking about their marriage and stuff like that. Yeah. And this is something that Brian Cogman told us when he was on the podcast, like, what, 2 years ago? And was also in that io9.com article that I referenced earlier, which is that these are show-invented scenes to actually pad out the running time because they came up short on the running time in some season one episodes. So they invented these interior two-hander scenes that they could just sort of put in there to try to develop character and inexpensively film, basically.
This is very interesting because, firstly, I don't even know why they would need to pad out running time because they're on HBO. They can do whatever running time they want. So that is a bit odd to me. But whatever.
Well, it was season one, so maybe they weren't, you know, like, we're Game of Thrones, we do what we want sort of thing, you know?
Right. These actually have two of my favorite moments in this episode and possibly of the whole series, or at least one of them has my favorite moments of the whole series. So this scene between Littlefinger and Varys, what is great about this scene is the oh shit look Varys gets on his face when Littlefinger says that he's been walking through the crypts or whatever with Illyrio, right? Varys is not expecting that at all, right? And
right.
He thought he had hidden himself, but Littlefinger knows everything.
Mm-hmm. The quote from Benioff is, "Since these scenes had not been part of the original outline of the season, they were not plot oriented so much as character discoveries. We had the chance to spend more with some of the players we felt had been shortchanged." So.
So what did you feel this scene illustrated about their characters? I think it just shows you a little bit of both, a little bit about how they both operate, mm-hmm. and that they have a lot of power. They have a lot of knowledge, right? And they're both kind of weaselly, slimy people. Right?
Well, I think these are men who are used to being the smartest person in the room, or at least, like, you know, the most well-informed person in the room. And the only... like, they are each other's only competitors in this particular realm. Because as much as you think that Littlefinger has the upper hand on Varys, that scene ends with them being called to the small council meeting and Littlefinger saying, "Why?" And Varys is like, "Oh, big news from overseas. Haven't you heard?" You know, so it's like, it's impossible to tell, really, who's the better, you know, spy master here. And that's
right.
Great.
Varys knowing about the illicit Daenerys. Activities, the illicit activities going on at Littlefinger's brothel as well.
Yeah. And this is the second scene in the same episode where Littlefinger gives someone shit for being gay, which is weird. I don't know. You would think that Littlefinger wouldn't care. But he gives Renly some shit for being gay. It's like his go-to insult when he's backed in a corner. When he's like losing to Renly at the tourney earlier in the episode, he, you know, makes some crack about Loras. And then the same thing with Varys. He's like, "Yeah, all your little birds are such pretty little boys. That's interesting, you know." So not a good look on you, Littlefinger, in my opinion. So
Wow, they're really doing a good job of character assassination on Littlefinger, I guess.
Otherwise, he's an angel.
Yeah, I didn't even take it really as homophobia. I took it more as like he knows secrets that people don't want to get out into the world.
That's fair. And right? I think if it had been like one gay thing, it wouldn't have mattered. But since it was like two in a row, I was like, all right, Littlefinger, let's ease up off the throttle there.
Littlefinger just straight out basically like, you know, implicitly threatening Varys to... by saying he'll disclose this information, you know.
Right.
I thought that was pretty great. Like, you and I are friends, and the way he talked through it was great writing. I really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
So, great little scene there. And what else? So then there's a small council meeting that happens later on in the episode. And this is the scene where Robert is saying he wants to kill Daenerys Targaryen, right?
Right.
And Ned... doesn't want to have any part of it.
Right.
I think the book does a good job of better establishing that, you know, Robert isn't the man that Ned once knew. Do you know what I mean? Because in the show, we only see one Robert and all of his actions seem fairly plausible, right?
Right.
But Ned kind of imagines that, hey, you know, the Robert I knew wouldn't do X. The Robert I knew would take this information about John Arryn's murder and use it, you know? Or take this information about Bran's attempted assassination and use it, and so on. And we don't really get as good of a sense of that in the show. But I do think that because the show does such a good job of establishing Ned as a noble character, this scene is really effective. What do you think?
Yeah, it is really good. You miss Barristan, I think, in this scene, because Barristan is on Ned's side, for one thing. So it's not just Ned against the entire, like, corrupt small council. And then also, to your point, in the book, Ned is able to say, hey, listen, we fought against Ser Barristan. And then when the war was over, we forgave him, and he's on your Kingsguard now. So this is what we do. We don't hold grudges forever, Robert, you know, right. And but Robert's just crazy when it comes to Targaryens. Cannot be reasoned with, basically.
Right. For reasons that we kind of have a sense of in both the show and the book. So great scene, great yelling by Robert. A lot of it's taken straight out of the book. I really liked it. It's obviously a very consequential scene because this is when Ned and Robert break, you know. So yeah, what else happens in this episode? There is a scene where Littlefinger goes into Ned's chamber afterwards and baits him, right?
I think so. Like, Ned's about to leave. Like, what if Ned had left right then? He'd still be alive, right?
Right.
So Littlefinger's like, okay, you could go.
Yeah, go ahead. Just don't look at the answer to this mystery that's dogged me for the last week.
Yeah, but just FYI, I can show you to the last person Jon Arryn talked to. I mean, go. It's fine.
It's
just
fine. Go. Yeah, I actually like the way they do it in the show better than the book because he is more like what you said, right?
Yeah.
It's more like, oh, don't worry about it. Just, it's fine. You know, you don't need to know. It's cool.
Yeah, it's fine.
The truth. Who cares? and so that's pretty awesome. And there is a scene where Loras shaves Renly. This is a show invention as well, right?
Oh, big time, yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this scene?
Okay, first we need to talk about Loras's hair.
Yes, we do.
I did some exploratory Googling today because Finn Jones, who plays Loras, has an amazing head of hair. This is true. Like, he's got beautiful, curly, luscious hair. And I cannot tell if they just didn't know how to treat it in the first season and were, like, kind of straightening it out and make it look stringy and awful, or if he's just another victim of the terrible wigs of season one. But all I'm just here to tell you that Finn Jones has amazing hair, but you wouldn't know it from this episode. He's got, like, a dead badger on his head. Okay. That's all I have to say about that.
I really like the scene. I think it does a good job of establishing the type of person Renly is for all of his good parts and bad parts, meaning he seems like a more reasonable person than Robert, for sure. But he's not as tough as Robert and cringes at the sight of blood, do you know? And may have pretty significant challenges becoming king, which we later find out involve him being murdered by a smoke monster.
Well, that's it's nothing to do with him being afraid of blood, right? Like, the things that are also established in the scene are that Renly is very popular and he's got a very rich boyfriend who could bankroll him. So this establishes Renly as a credible candidate.
Exactly.
Basically, for the throne.
Agreed.
Yeah, which you wouldn't get if we didn't have this scene. If Renly was just like hanging out the small council of the tourney, you'd still be struggling to understand who he was.
Who he was. You would barely recognize him. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're like, oh, it's the gay dude.
Exactly.
Oh, who had his chest shaved by his boyfriend. Okay. You know.
So. Right. So, yeah, I thought this is a very effective scene and a nice little scene that does a good job, especially because, like, later on, I would say in season two, you know, the conflict between the different people vying for the throne becomes more clear. And so basically the more character development you get, the better off you're going to be, right?
I know. We haven't even met Stannis yet. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is crazy.
In this scene, Loras says Stannis has the personality of a lobster, which I think is tough but fair.
I did like all the things that were in the book that hinted at future things that we would see, right? So there was a mention of using a person with no face, right, to murder Daenerys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they chose not to because they're too expensive.
Right.
And there was a couple of other things that they sprinkled in
Thoris of Myr keeps popping up.
Right. A couple of the things that they just sprinkled in there, just that we in the show know will become major plot points later, but that at this point are just a glimmer in George R. R. Martin's eye. So, anyway, what else happens at King's Landing? There's this great scene, which has is probably one of my favorite scenes in all of Game of Thrones, which is a complete show invention.
That's so funny.
what? Did you hate this scene?
We're going to fight about it. No. We're not going to fight about it. We're going to disagree about it.
All right. So this is a scene between Cersei and Robert. And they have this conversation where they talk about their feeling. You know, she says, hey, sorry you and Ned broke up. You know, it was an ill-fated marriage. And, hey, you know, we could have been a thing, right? We could have been a thing, the two of us. This marriage could have happened, and then it's just. I found this to be very moving because they're basically these two people been married for decades. There is no love between them. They have this mutual understanding of the situation they're in, and I found it very touching. But what didn't you like about the scene, Joanna?
Yeah, but I don't think that's who Cersei is. I think this is an example of the show softening Cersei. I mean, another example, right, is when she goes to talk to Catelyn and, like, cries about losing her child.
Who, by the way, is mentioned again in the scene, which is – and then retconned out of the show later on.
Right. And so, you know, they added these scenes. They made Cersei, I just think, a little softer in the show. And I just don't know that they needed to do that.
I think they made her human. I think it made her like a human being, in my opinion.
I guess I feel like I would rather see Cersei be human via, you know, concern for her child or like her weird stuff with her dad or all of those relationships. But to lay in a longing for a love story with Robert that isn't there, you know, like I feel like in the books, we know that Cersei is pissed that Robert like got basically like fat and bloated and makes a fool of her, like that he was this young, handsome, strapping, you know, god, and now he's become all dissipated and is constantly cheating on her all over the place. But she never loved him. She loves Jaime. So for her to be like, you know, oh, we could have had a loving relationship, that just doesn't – I think that's a mistake. I agree with you that it's good to humanize, you know, we could talk – tangentially really quickly about Daredevil and just say that the Vincent D'Onofrio character who's the bad guy in that, the way that they humanized him made that one of my favorite TV shows of last year. So I think humanizing your monsters is very important. But it just not, I don't agree with this way.
See, I didn't really take it like that at all. I took it more like, hey, there was a time when I was about to marry you that I did feel something and that dissipated very quickly. Do you know? And it just spoke to, hey, this woman was willing to give this marriage a chance. And it might have lasted like 2 weeks, but she was still willing to give it a chance. Robert exterminated any possibility of that. And it struck me as pretty plausible.
You want to know the horrible truth? I can't even remember what she looked like. I only know she was the one thing I ever wanted. Someone took her away from me. And seven kingdoms couldn't fill the hole she left behind.
I felt something for you once, you know.
I know.
Even after we lost our first boy. For quite a while, actually. Was it ever possible for us? Was there ever a time, ever a moment?
No. Does that make you feel better or worse?
Doesn't make me feel anything.
I guess it wasn't clear to me from either the book or the show, maybe I missed something, that the love affair with Jaime was always there. Do you know?
Oh, yeah.
It was happening the whole time. Right?
It was.
Okay.
It's always been like, they've always been this way.
Gotcha.
And that, I mean, it's like sick and gross, but it's been like a sickness and gross thing for them their whole lives, basically.
But so. In the show, that's not 100% clear, right?
I guess. Would argue. Yeah.
And so I think in the context of the show, it works really well. But that's me. And I love the line she says at the end of how I feel nothing, because again, so many layers to that line, right?
Because that reminds me of one of my favorite Mad Men scenes, right, where character of Ginsburg is talking to Don Draper in the elevator, yes. And he's like,
I feel sorry for you, and he says, yeah, I don't think about you at all.
Yeah, I don't think about you at all. It's just like, oh, ice. Yeah. So when Cersei's like, Robert says something like, does that make you feel? I forget what he says, and then she says, I don't feel anything at all.
Right. Which I would say that in Mad Men, when Don Draper says that, he's being serious.
Right, and she's covering.
She's kind of covering. Like, maybe she did feel something, but she stomped it out, and she needs to pretend like she didn't feel anything anyway. You know,
I mean, no matter what, even if I think that direction to go in the script is a mistake, I think Lena Headey is amazing in that scene. The play of emotion on her face is really subtle and really, really
very. Yeah, that's why I love that. This was probably one of the scenes that kind of sold this show for me. When I was first watching it, I was like, oh my gosh, that was brilliant. And I'm with this show for the long haul, which I have been, John Robinson, and here we are. So what else happens? Ned goes to the Littlefinger's brothel. They talk about this other bastard that apparently Robert fathered. And in the book, they are far more descriptive about all the bastards that Robert has. And they're more extensively describing the lineage there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're trying to get out of there, Jaime attacks and kills all his men. What do you think of this sequence of events, Joanna?
I think it's amazing. See, this is a show invention, right? Because in the book, Jaime leaves and he doesn't have this like showdown with Ned. He's like, kill all of his men, and then Jaime leaves, right?
Right.
This is so good. This is like what hooks me on Game of Thrones. It's Sean Bean, Nicola Costa-Waldau being amazing. There's so much history between these characters. This pays off a scene from last week or 2 weeks ago, right? With 2 weeks ago, I think, right? With Ned and Jaime in the throne room, where Jaime's basically saying, like, you couldn't take me. And Ned basically saying, yeah, I think I could. You fought the right people. You know, Jaime's like, I can't be beat. And Ned's like, maybe you haven't fought the right person yet, meaning me. I will destroy you. And so there's this.
But we never really find the answer out, right?
Well, that's why it's so great, because there's this showdown and they're doing it. And then this goddamn stupid Lannister guy comes in and, you know, spears Ned through the leg. And Jaime's so mad because he's like, I wanted to know the answer. Right. I want to know if I was better than Ned Stark. Oh, it's so good. There's just so many layers there.
I want to know what that guy was thinking, because they're clearly not intervening for the first, you know, 2 minutes that they're fighting.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he's like, wait a second, maybe I should intervene. Maybe I got to help this guy. You know, like, what is his thought process? I guess maybe Ned just got too close to him, and he's like, you know what? It would really be wrong to not do something at this point.
So. Yeah, I don't know. I think he thought he was helping. I just love that Jaime clocks him, basically knocks him out. This is one of my favorite season one Jaime scenes, maybe my favorite. Not the least of which because his coat looks so beautiful in this duel. But like, actually, I was rewatching this scene on YouTube last week after we talked about poor Jory getting the dagger through the eye, and which is poignant, right? Isn't it?
Yeah,
you don't care about Jory.
No. I did find it poignant, and it was very horrifying the way it was done and shot. And Jory's still like alive.
Yeah,
you know, when the dagger's
he's
reacting to the dagger. Yeah. Do you know that? Yeah. That's pretty horrifying. I don't know if that would actually happen in real life. But I don't know if your brain would just shut down in that situation. But the way the camera shoots it, and like Jaime like looks Ned in the eyes while he has his dagger through Jory's eye,
right? And Ned is like, "This is my bro. This is my this is my right hand man." And like he's we just see Jory being, you know, especially there's the little scene between Jory and Arya early in this episode where, you know, he's calling her little lady and just being really sweet. And you're just like, this is a very important member of the family, even though he's not actually a member of the family.
Yeah,
and
they did a good job building up Jory as a character.
Yeah, also. And so for him, I mean, it's only episode 5. He's dead. And Yeah, but okay. So I was watching, I was watching it on YouTube last week, and just because I wanted to watch that one scene, and one of the comments really cracked me up, where it gave a timestamp, and it was like, right here, Littlefinger looks like the good guy, and Jamie looks like the bad guy, right? Because Littlefinger comes running out, he's like, "What's the meaning of this? I'll go get the city watch," as if he's like a hero and not some asshole who's like been trying to orchestrate, you know, Ned's downfall since he got to King's Landing. So right. That's a great scene. I love it.
Well, it's also implied. Yeah, it's an amazing scene. Just an amazing way to end an episode.
Yes.
Spectacular. I mean, it's not even really a cliffhanger. It's just kind of, wow. You know, this is the world that Game of Thrones is. He'll just kill all your men on a whim, yeah. Right? Not even any broader purpose to it, just because he's pissed that day.
He wants
his brother back. He wants his brother back.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Just an amazing way to end the episode. Really an awesome mic.
Well, it's funny because, like, you know, watching this, if you're watching it for the first time, haven't seen Game of Thrones, you're like, oh my God, our hero just got speared through the leg. Little do you know that your hero is going to get his head chopped off in a few episodes. But, like, this seems really serious. You're like, oh my God, our hero Ned is in dire straits. What's going to happen?
Right. I can't wait for the rest of the hero's journey to play out.
I can't wait for him to get back on the up and up again. Speaking of which, we forgot to talk about the Veil of the Eerie.
Oh, no. We're going to get to it.
Okay.
But yeah, I do like how, like, until this point, the show is still following kind of conventional hero's journey conventions, right? That this could theoretically be a show in which the good guys overcome their trials and tribulations to triumph mm-hmm. at this point still.
Mm-hmm.
That, ooh, wow, tension, bad things happening, but, you know, I'm sure it's all going to work out.
It's only episode 5. It's going to swing back around, of course.
I mean, can you recall when you first read the book, you know, did you still feel as though Ned would make it out in the end?
Yeah.
You still had that thought in your head, right? That, like, hey, yeah, everything's going to be okay for Ned.
Were you spoiled when you watched Baylor? Like, did you know? Yeah, all right.
No idea. And
if we can only turn back time and get a reaction video of you watching Baylor. There is that great, there is maybe the ultimate Game of Thrones reaction videos from season 1
yes.
of a fan reacting to Ned Stark's death. So
it is a spectacular moment. And also just, I mean, we're going to get to it in a few episodes, of course, but the way that episode is shot to imply that something's going to happen to stop it. It's just such a brilliant moment. And, you know, the way that the show is marketed too was with Ned as the hero. So, all right. So we got some stuff at the Eerie Vale this week. Let's wrap up with that. Catelyn and Tyrion go on the road, and they're besieged by brigands. What's clear in the book, and I don't even think is really clear in the show, is that the people who are backing up Catelyn at this point are sellswords, right?
Yes.
That's why Bronn's
well,
with them.
No, some are. Like, Bronn is a sellsword, but then she also sort of...
She also has her bannermen. She has some of her own folks, and then there's her bannermen that she kind of called out, right?
Yeah. Like the bannermen from the people who are loyal to her father.
Right. But basically, like, it's a hodgepodge of people. It's not just like Catelyn's people.
Right.
Yeah. And they're attacked, and Tyrion saves her life, which I think is a show invention, if I recall. Right? Is that right? Or...
They get attacked, and Tyrion defends himself, but this whole, like, him saving Catelyn
right.
thing is a show invention. Yeah. It's pretty gross, right?
Yeah.
He, like, caves this guy head.
It's like some irreversible action going on there.
Yeah.
Or any other show in which a person's head is caved in or movie. So they get past that, and, you know, what's great about the show is you see Tyrion go from being tied up to then he doesn't need to be tied up anymore, which means even though Catelyn doesn't trust him, she at least doesn't feel like he needs to be restrained at all times. There's kind of this evolution there that's kind of cool. In the book, there's this massive passage about how difficult it is to get to the top of the Veil,
oh my
right?
God, I'm so glad that was cut, to be honest.
it does. This is the thing that I thought of, you know, is that with one look, one shot, one matte painting or digital matte painting, you can get a sense of how impenetrable it is, right? This is what the brilliance of having it on a TV show is, that you can't do in a book, right?
Well, they scaled it down too, because it's like seven castles, right? And and all the sort of crazy winding steps that you have to go up to get to it and stuff like that. So they made it a little more streamlined in the show. But yeah, I mean, it's still, it looks formidable.
Yeah, you just say, hey, it's impregnable. Look at it. Oh yeah, that looks pretty difficult. Boom, you're done. Move on. You know what I mean? It reminds me of how, did you ever see that movie, American Psycho?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how in the book, there's basically all these like chapters of all the stuff that Patrick Bateman buys and all the stuff he's into. And in the movie, all you need is a shot of him having sex with a prostitute and flexing in the mirror. And that's like that just conveys the entire character with like a glance. That's kind of, I don't know why that came to mind, but it did.
You just wanted to zing Brett Easton Ellis and say that the movie's better than the book. And
That's right.
Suck it, Brett Easton Ellis.
Especially, I mean, you guys are listening to this 2 weeks from today, but especially, did you see that tweet he made today?
No.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah.
So
I just don't like him in general. So
Brett Easton Ellis made this tweet today where he said, dinner with a filmmaker / cinephile last night, and we both agreed 2015 is the worst year ever for American film. An infection has arrived. ... End quote.
He's such a terrible human being. I dredged up all these old, like, awful tweets of his when I was writing about his Tarantino profile. Because, like, basically his Tarantino profile for The Times was him – I read it as him pushing Tarantino to agree with all these, like, vile things that Brett Easton Ellis has said over the years. Like, that Catherine Bigelow is overrated, that Selma's overrated, all this stuff. Like, these are all things that Brett Easton Ellis has tweeted over the years, and he, like – you know, asked Quentin Tarantino repeatedly until Quentin Tarantino kind of agreed with him. I'm not saying Tarantino's like the victim here. I'm just saying like Tarantino came off looking bad, but you know, Brett Easton Ellis is the real devil here. I
just mean this year has been a great film for year for film.
No, I know. It just
Mad Max Fury Road, The Martian.
Brett Easton Ellis is a bad human and yes. Wrong.
All right, so we're way far off track here.
Sorry.
No worries.
Oh, I've never apologized for bashing that guy.
Okay. I want to tell you the thought process I had when reading the book. Okay, I was reading the book, and they get to this scene where Catelyn arrives, and she's talking with her sister,
Lysa,
and the whole time I kept thinking to myself, you know what? These freaking showrunners—they invented this whole thing where her son is like sucking at her breast to make it really disturbing. And, like, shame on you, show, for making it even weirder and grosser than it had to be. And then, of course, it happens in the book as well.
But in the book, it's, like, in her private chamber. It's not, correct, like, in her throne room. And it opens with, like, Robin's mouth on her breast.
Oh, and it's all wet, too. Ugh. Oh, my gosh. And you see, like, a close. It's just, like, he has all of it all over his mouth.
Ugh, so gross.
Yeah. I mean, how did you feel it translated to the show? Did you think that was gratuitous and excessive, or?
I mean, it's gross, but Lysa Arryn is crazy, so it's fine. Like,
she's far more reasonable in the book, I think.
Yeah, she is. For me, I really love Michelle Fairley and Peter Dinklage's like reaction faces.
Yes,
that's my favorite part of that whole scene. I can't remember if we get a Bronn face. I don't think we do, but Michelle Fairley and Peter Dinklage, like. You know, Michelle Fairley especially, because Kat is like, oh my God, this is my sister. What has happened?
It's more clear in the book that, you know, John Aaron's death kind of drove her to this madness in some ways, right?
Well, yeah, and Littlefinger manipulating her, I think.
Yes, which we don't find out until later. And it should be clear also that Littlefinger's manipulations involve her putting Kat onto Tyrion, correct? Him putting Kat onto Tyrion, meaning that he said it belongs to Tyrion Lannister, right? The blade. It was his blade, and then Tyrion Lannister won it, right?
In a bet where Tyrion's like, I never would bet against Jaime.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess Tyrion, Littlefinger was just kind of shaking things up a bit by doing that, right?
Well, I mean, I think as weird as it sounds, even though Varys and Littlefinger are not working together, I feel like they have the same purpose, which is to pit the Starks and the Lannisters against each other. And for Varys, it's so he can weaken the base and bring the Targaryens in. And for Littlefinger, it's to advance his own agenda, which includes taking down Ned Stark because he hates the Starks.
Right.
And yeah, so I think anything that he and Varys can do to sow discord between the Lannisters and the Starks, they're doing.
Yeah,
you know, in little subtle ways that we don't realize when we watch the first season, because we think, you know, apart from this like weird shadowy dungeon conversation, that we kind of think that they're on Ned's side because he's our hero. And that's what happens, right? You're the hero and you come in and people help you. No, wrong.
Indeed.
So
the last scene we see of Tyrion is of him in the dungeon, which is a very effective dungeon design. You know, it ensures that it's going to be very difficult to escape from there. I really dug the whole design of the Eyrie, although it was difficult for me to wrap my head around.
I love the sky cells.
The sky cells are great, but the idea that this is a gigantic hole in the throne room that, mm-hmm. like, I'm like, okay, so this thing is like, it's just like jutting out, right? It must be over this massive cliff.
I think that map painting that you're talking about, what you see is that it's hollow in the center.
Mm, yes.
That basically you have this big structure that's up and then you can see through it in the middle. And that's what the moon door sits over, I think.
That sounds very plausible. But overall, I thought the design was great.
Yeah.
I mean, It just looks amazing. And the way they pull it off using what was probably slightly more limited resources they have today, very effective. So, and that's basically every scene in the episode, Jonah Robinson. Any overall thoughts? I thought this was a fantastic episode. Everything I love about Game of Thrones in this episode.
Yeah, it's a great, great episode. Yeah. It's just so funny as we're reading the book and I hope you guys are enjoying reading along or listening to us at least talk about it. What's so funny is how much they lift just directly.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes maybe a little too directly, you know, like, do we need Barristan talking about whether or not Sir Hugh has relatives? I don't know that that's necessary, you know, like stuff like that, but it's in the book. So it's in the show. Yeah. But mercifully cutting out how long it takes to get up to the Eyrie. So a great episode. Loved it.
Agreed. And yeah, like as I've already mentioned several times, awesome ending for an episode. Overall, yeah, this is one of my favorite episodes definitely of the season. And because stuff is happening, man. Things are happening of consequence that will follow these characters for a really long time. I just – this reinforces my belief that season one's the best season. So let's wrap it up. Stay tuned to hear what you need to read for next week's episode of the podcast. In the meantime, Jonah Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me at vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
And find my directorial debut at theprimaryinstinct.com, where you can buy my film, The Primary Instinct. So, Joanna, where should people read to for next time?
It's page 500 in my book, and that is Daenerys chapter 5 through page 500 in my paperback of A Game of Thrones.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.